You're joining us for another episode of College Talks and More, brought to you by MyBookCart.com. This series brings together students, parents, and professionals sharing their voices on a variety of college and life topics.
It's all about students, parents, and all of our listeners finding the information, encouragement, and thrive they need for a successful college and life experience.
Welcome to College Talks and More with your hosts, Hannah
and Carrie.
Today on our show, we have with us bestselling author David Crowe. He is with us today to discuss his memoir, The Pale-Faced Lie. In the book, David discusses growing up on the Navajo Indian Reservation with his idolized dad, his mentally ill mother, and three siblings. His father's stories of his Cherokee heritage and World War II feats put him on a pedestal until David discovered the other side of his father, Thurston Crowe, who was an ex-con with his own code of ethics that justified cruelty, lies, and even murder.
I find it remarkable that after all your struggles, you found a way to graduate high school, go on to college, become a businessman by starting your own lobbying firm. You even got married and are living the happy life now. Everybody struggles with something, but this book shows that it is never too late or too much that one can handle. You can always turn your life around no matter what the circumstances. Having an abusive criminal father, a childlike mother, learning and medical issues did not stop our author, David Crowe. Now, let's jump into his book and discuss further. David, please give us an overview of yourself and life.
Well, an overview of myself and maybe the book. So I'm born 9 months after my father gets out of San Quentin for a crime could have gotten him the death penalty. He fled to the Navajo Indian Reservation. My older sister was born while he was in prison. And he did that for two reasons. One, you could pretty much lie about the criminal felony box if you came up with any kind of recommendations. In the 50s and 60s, they were desperate for any kind of skilled labor. And that's the first reason we went there. The second is my father really believed that his accomplice would try to kill him because my father betrayed him. My father wasn't afraid of him per se, but he was afraid of an ambush. And so that's why we wound up there very early on. My first memories, my dad says, we got to get rid of your mother. She's crazy. We got to get rid of her. And from that moment on, he tried to pull me into his criminal enterprise. And that lasted all the way until the showdown part of this book.
Now, the book has a very interesting title, I think. Why did you decide to name your book, The Pale-Faced Lie?
Very good question. So we grew up on the Navajo Indian Reservation, largest in the country. And my father kind of developed this, you could probably call it psychopathic. But he decided that we were Cherokees. This was our sister tribe, the Navajos. But the Cherokees, of course, were superior to everybody, all other Indians and all other people. And that was his persona. So I grew up believing that we were Cherokee and we're living on a reservation that would like us because, well, we're connected. We're all Indians. So the book will take you through a series of lies that are like peeling an onion and lie after lie after lie that I discover. I began at age 4 and all the way till I'm 27 when the book ends. And there are many, many lies, but of those lies, it's my journey with thinking I'm an Indian.
Wow, that's really interesting. How did you cope with everything that went on between your mother and father?
By getting the heck out of the house. From the second I was old enough to walk or run, I was out of the house from the moment I could leave till the moment I had to come back. And I would run very, very hard every day, you know, and I realize I'm told now that sort of creates a lot of endorphins and helps fight off depression. And the other thing I did is, even though I'm dyslexic and nearsighted, I put just a fanatic amount of energy into reading, and I could escape there. I ran and escaped, I read and escaped, and I tried to get to know my Indian neighbors, everything about the reservation, would talk to anybody who would talk to me. And that was my escape.
That's very understandable that you just wanted to get out of the house.
Yes.
What kind of crimes did your father commit where you had to help him?
Well, where my dad and I really built our relationship was stealing very expensive tools on the reservation. So my father worked for Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he had access to all of the warehouses all over the reservation. So the reservation, the Navajo reservation, is bigger than West Virginia, then about 200,000 people. So it was, you could drive 150 miles and scarcely see a person on some parts of the reservation. So these warehouses were spread out all over the reservations, and he would steal just enough tools from each of them, thinking no one would notice. And then we would drive to the border town of Gallup, New Mexico, which plays a big role in the book. And he would fence them or sell them to these Mexican businessmen, if you want to call them that. And we spent most of our weekends stealing and him explaining to me that every rule on the reservation is nothing but a hypocritical lie. And stealing from people who stole from them is just getting even. But also in those conversations, I began to learn about San Quentin, what a maximum security prison is like, all his fellow prisoners, his cellmate in the fish tank. And then he gradually told me about some murders he had committed. Always he was self-righteously defending his own good morals and character. But I grew to realize he was a very violent man, and that's the reason he was sent to a maximum security prison.
On that note, to your knowledge, how many murders did your father commit?
He told me about one when he was in the Navy. Some guy insulted him in New Orleans on shore leave, and some like 2 or 3 in the morning behind some bar told me he beat a man to death. He told me that he killed a couple of guys in San Quentin who attacked him, and I know that he had a very brutal time there that's described in the book. And then as I got older, when we moved from the reservation to Washington, D.C. in high school, he had a job with a senator who wound up losing his election, and he wanted to kill the senator because the senator wasn't willing to call any favors to help him. During all of our discussions, I would learn that he had killed people that he felt like he deserved to kill. But there's one particular incident for the showdown that really stands out. When I was a junior in college, went to College Park, Maryland, University of Maryland, my father had left my stepmother. At this point, he's living with an 18-year-old Indian woman from the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. Anyway, he was involved in another tool fencing scam in West Virginia. Apparently, some things went wrong. So the woman my dad was living with, named Caroline, called me a couple of times at school and said, hey, I think your dad may have killed somebody. Somebody may be trying to kill him. They're calling and hanging up on us. And oh, by the way, your father disappeared for 6 days and no one's heard from him. So these types of events went on. And then on one critical day, I got a call that I had to drive 5 hours to West Virginia, meet him at a truck stop. And I followed him and two men in the, this is in the dark on a one-lane dirt road. They pulled what is certainly a human body out of the trunk. It was wrapped in a tarp, and they buried it, this whatever, but I think a man. And my job was to take my dad home all the way back, drop him off, and we got in a huge fight. And I said, I could very well be aiding and abetting a murder. I don't know what you're doing, but it smells like human blood to me. And we got in a giant fight. It was during that fight, we were screaming at each other the entire 5 hours. I told him, you know, I have nothing to do with you. You're sick, and this is crazy, and I feel certain you didn't bury a deer or something. I mean, this is really has to be murder. And he said, and he just started into, everybody commits murder. The Army commits murder. Presidents commit murder. CIA commits murder. And I do it. That was the most in-depth conversation we ever had. He had a bloody duffel bag in the back seat of my car, and he got out. I got out, and first time in my life really physically challenging him, I just stood face to face, said, we're done, and I ought to turn you in. If I had any courage at all, I'd go call and turn you in. And he grabbed me by the throat and said, I own you. You'll do whatever I tell you to do, or you know what happens to you. So we had some very brutal moments. There are others described in the book that your reader will see. Where my father revealed himself was when I was smart enough or lucky enough to interject a question when he got in his angry mode, which blood vessels, you know, kind of bulged out on his forehead, his eyes kind of bugged out like a frog, and he would start telling me about things. And eventually the stories made sense because I was able to connect them. And when he got into a rage, he'd always explain, sometimes people just have to get taken out. That's part of the code. And so I was able to piece together quite a few things that he did that were of quite a violent nature.
Wow, that's pretty unbelievable. And it took a lot of courage to stand up to a man like that. In the beginning of the book, you do mention that your father says quite a few times when you were young that you needed to get rid of your mother, or your family needed to get rid of your mother. And eventually your family does leave her.
Yes.
How did you manage to live with the guilt?
Well, I didn't. So one of the biggest incidents in the book, and my very mentally ill, very fragile mother, she's abandoned in a house that we rented in Gallup, New Mexico. So we turn off the electricity, the water, take all the food out, and leave her a note. We don't want you. We're leaving. So I did not know at that moment, learned that my father cut both my mom's brakes. And Gallup, New Mexico is built into kind of a small mountain. It not only is it near Indian land, it's where coal land is, not unlike West Virginia. So there are nothing but steep hills all around that house. And he thought she would hit her brakes and get hit and killed. So to kind of focus this, so we abandon her and it breaks my heart, right? I just don't know what to do. And I felt broken inside. But about a week later, my dad, we moved on to a spot on the reservation 25 miles away from that house. About a week later, he drove me back to Gallup, and we're sitting in front of the house that we have just abandoned. And I think, and he expected to read or hear that my mother was dead because the brakes failed and she got killed. But he hadn't heard that news, and he didn't have any idea where she was. And so we sat in front of the house for over an hour with binoculars. There's like a front window to this house. And finally he says, you have to go inside and see if she's there. And of course, it's the last thing I wanted to do, but he hit me and I went in, crept through the stairs up the back through the basement. Nothing was locked. And in the corner of an empty living room is my mother. And there's some dirty clothes piled in the middle and one thin mattress that's stained, which is what he left her. And as I stared at her, I could see her face and eyes, the top part, but she didn't know I was there. And to describe it, it's like the face of that woman on the National Geographic page where you just see complete and total hopelessness. And at 10 years old, I knew at that moment I had seen complete hopelessness. There was a vacant, near dead look. And I started shaking and I started crying. And finally she realized I was there. And she got up and came over to me and hugged me with the strength of like an NFL linebacker. Please don't leave me. Don't abandon me. Don't leave me like this. Well, at that point, my dad knew I'd been gone too long. And he came up behind me, shoved her to the floor, hit me, dragged me to the car and said, you'll never be much of a man. You're not a man. You know, you're a little coward, mama's boy. And he drove me back to my brothers and sisters on the reservation. And I kept that moment to myself for 45 more years till I began to write this book. And it did break me. The guilt, the shame, the hurt, indescribable. And to get rid of that, and the book goes into that, was one of the very, very hardest things I've ever done in my life. Could never tell my wife, could never tell my kids, I could never tell anybody what I witnessed and, in my mind, participated in that day.
Wow, that really does sound horrible.
Yeah, it was. Just looking at her, yeah.
Did you ever confront your dad about his behavior and abuse towards your mother, your sisters, your brother, and yourself? And did you ever confront your mom about her failure to be your mother?
Yes, those are very good questions. Whenever I hear from people who are critical of me, it's that I didn't do it sooner in life. But what happened was when I was 55, I'm 67 now, be 68 August 16th, I would continue from my Washington, D.C. office, clients all over the country. So I got to fly a lot. And I would always rent a car in Albuquerque and drive it to Gallup and sit in front of that house. I knew that house held the key to what was broken inside me. I knew it, and I just like every trip, every 3 or 4 months, I'd make a trip out and drive all over the reservation, but I'd sit in front of that house. And so one day when I was doing that, a man came out of the house, knocked on the car window and said, "Hey, you're stalking me. Why do you keep showing up in different cars and just staring at this house?" So I said, "Well, I was a little boy and left this house." And I told him, you know, when I lived there. And he said, "Well, I don't believe you. The kid that was here couldn't have been more than 10 years old." I said, "Yeah, that was 45 years ago." And so long story short, he invited me into the house. He was a widower, very, very nice man. He worked for the city of Gallup. He was a widower and he had 2 kids that lived away. And he brought me up into the house and made me a meal. It's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we talked till 2 a.m. And I recalled everything just like an explosion out of a, you know, fire hydrant, every single thing that ever happened. And he listened and listened and listened. At the end of that, he said, "You've finally gotten this off your chest. You're at a new beginning. Don't lose this chance since you've never told anybody." So I went back to the hotel I was staying at. And since it's earlier in the West than the East, I woke up and about 7 a.m., 8 a.m., I called my father and got him on one ring. And I said, "Did it ever bother you? All that you did to our mother, to all 4 of your children, the brutality, and he cut me off and he said, "You are no good SOB. You're a coward. You never did what I wanted you to do. I knew you would never be much of a man. And guess what? You aren't." And he hung up. I called my mother, and after a few rings, she picked up. And I said, "Did it ever occur to you? You asked me to be head of house at 10. To save you, to stand up to my father, to earn a living so that you didn't have to live on welfare, and that you should have never put that burden on a kid." And she said, "You never were the son you should have been. You never protected me. You have a lot to feel guilty about, and this is on you." And she put the phone down. And at that minute, my forgiveness of them began, the journey to forgive them. And in that process, I forgave myself with shame and guilt. Because one of the things I learned is that when we seek forgiveness, you always hope or expect that the person you're asking acknowledges what they did, says they're sorry in a meaningful way, and there's healing. But when you grow up in a situation like mine, and I don't think I'm alone, and you get people that are really mentally ill and everything's about them, what happens is they blame you. It's always going to be your fault. You could ask them, you could tell them they need to forgive themselves or forgive you. That argument is circular. It's never headed anywhere. But I realized I had to forgive them, and I had to understand there would never be any sort of satisfaction or justice from them. And once I really understood that, the journey to heal began.
I couldn't imagine a father or mother saying that to their son, but I am glad that it started your forgiveness process.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I learned, and I'm quite sure that there are better people than me and great books, therapists, but when I'm asked about it personally, and I'm asked a lot, and I did a book tour, and I would run into various people, and they'd be crying, you know, oftentimes about, "I read this part of your book, it made me cry," and I'd always ask them, "What part of my book made you?" And when they told me, I knew what happened to them, right? There's everything from sexual abuse to physical abuse. I mean, you name it, right? And I would ask them, "Have you been able to forgive that person?" "Well, no, I hate them." I said, "Well, I get that. What they did is hateable. But you're carrying this around with you like it happened 5 minutes ago." And they said, "Well, yeah, I can't help it." And I said, "Yeah, you can. You can forgive what is unforgivable by simply saying to yourself, I'm not a part of that anymore. I didn't cause that. I can't fix that." It's one of the most powerfully negative things that a childhood like mine does is you grow to believe you deserve it. And you grow to believe you can't do better than that. And I think that's why a lot of cycles are repeated that are very negative. And it's an extremely hard thing to break. But once you do, there's a freedom that you never thought possible.
When did you start to figure out the truth about your dad, seeing that he made himself out to be something he wasn't? And With learning the truth about your dad, did that help or hinder you in your forgiveness process?
Well, let me, I have a good answer for you, but it's not quite that. So I knew from age 4, 5, 6 that when dad raised his chest up and his voice got loud, that he's making stuff up, right? And, you know, he's a full-blooded Cherokee and his father was savagely treated by the white man and on and on. And so, but the way he told the stories began to give me an inkling, the tell, right? How can you tell somebody's lying? And the other thing is I would listen in with my good right ear to my parents' door late at night. I was always a little sort of mischievous sleuth. So I would crawl up and I would hear them talk. And there was several themes that recurred, you know, dad being in San Quentin, not being able to tell his kids, dad trying to kill a man or maybe did kill a man or two, that they kept repeating. These themes kept repeating. So when I'd ask dad, did you eat a bologna sandwich today? I'd get an honest answer. Or did you get a promotion? You know, what's going on? But if you ask him anything about his past, particularly as it to his particular heritage, I could tell he was lying, but I couldn't piece together the truth. And you're a kid, you want to believe your family. I don't know if I'm getting ahead of us, but one of the most consequential things that happened in my life was when I was in college, first time I dropped out. You know, I just went through some things that I went back to the reservation and got a job in construction. I'm like 19 or 20. And I kept going back to my little hometown of Fort Defiance. And one of my seven angels in life was a code talker, Navajo Indian gentleman, who was my 4-H teacher, Little League baseball coach, and his son was my best friend. So one day I went by the house and his wife said, Mr. Koontz wants to talk to you. So I went out and talked to him in the backyard and he said, you're not an Indian. Your dad's not an Indian. You don't belong here. Your umbilical cord wasn't buried on the reservation. He said, you got a lot of Indian kids here. They're going to drink themselves to death or do manual labor. But you're not from here. Get out and don't come back. And I loved this guy. And he was a mentor. And he was the kind of friend that what he said was incredibly powerful. It was mean. But when I later realized he was giving me a good dose of tough love, I didn't come back until I graduated from college, and then I did only as a visitor. So it was a gradually like unpeeling this onion. And did I confront dad? I did once. He and I went through several different things. One, he never spoke to me for like 12, 15 years. Then towards the end of his life, he needed me. And one of the things I did one day is confront him with this whole Indian thing. And as old as he was, he got so upset, I thought he was going to have a stroke right on the spot. So I said, okay, I'll never bring it up again. And another thing I did was bring up what he had done to the guy that helped him commit the crime, his accomplice. I said, you destroyed this man's life. I went and reconnected. I connected with his son, who knew nothing of the San Quentin business, and he and I are friends. And I just want you to know, your accomplice died penniless, never got this off this record, never was able to earn more than $1.85 an hour. You destroyed a family. And I thought he was going to die, and he just screamed at me, get the hell out of my house. And I said, I'm the only one of your 4 kids that talks to you. I'm your legal guardian. I'm your medical guardian. If you never want to talk to me again, that's fine. But you need to think this over because I'm fine. If you need me, fine. Let me know. And if you don't, that's fine too. So the next day he called me, said, come over. Don't ever bring any of this up again. So at that point, he would tell me prison stories. He would tell me all kinds of things as long as I didn't ask him what he did.
Wow, that's really interesting. You talk in your book so much about negative stuff in your childhood. Were there really any good times or positive memories that you have about your childhood?
Yeah, I mean, I think like all bad families, there are moments, but most of the moments were out of the house. I made a wide variety of friends. I mean, my 3 Navajo friends from childhood are still my best friends. And there were a lot of families that would let me come over and eat dinner with them, stay. And there were days my dad was in a good mood. No one had knocked the chip off his shoulder that day. He didn't feel overly inferior that day. You know, any little incident could just trigger a massive reaction. But let's say he had a good day, got 8 hours sleep, got good food, nothing bothered him. And he hadn't walked out the door yet to face the world that was going to make him mad. He would tell stories, and he was incredibly smart. Incredibly smart, maybe the smartest person I've ever known. He didn't have formal education, but he read everything, and he expected me to. So he would just start a conversation with me. Who do you think was greater, Galileo, Christ, or Sir Isaac Newton? Or do you want to know how Arizona and New Mexico formed? 5 million years ago, this was an ocean. And Dad and I played intellectual information game. And if I read something he hadn't read, oh, that was, red letter day for me. So all of our enjoyment was about that mental sparring where he thought I could be somewhat equal. But if anything made him mad, that just dissolved.
Your dad sounds like a very complicated and explosive.
Oh my God. One of the stories, and there are thousands of them, I hope people will like them. Dad and I came back from a tool stealing venture on a late Saturday afternoon in the summer. And there's a bar called the Navajo Inn that's a half mile off the Navajo Indian Reservation into Arizona. So it's not on the reservation. And at the time, it was the largest single beer and wine distributor in both states. And not only was it not a town, it was just a kind of a warehouse thing that was a packaged liquor store. But they served so much alcohol there that they actually sent full trucks from California loaded with wine and beer and everything. So it was extremely notorious, this Navajo Inn, extremely. And any given day, there'd be four or five people dead lying on the street or the sidewalk. And in winter, they got really cold and their lips were blue and they were known as popsicles, which is not nice, but dead frozen Navajo was a popsicle. So we come around this corner where Navajo End is and we're looking at these beautiful rocks, which both states have. And there's a truck with a BIA license tag and it has hit what's this rock called the Haystacks, which is gigantic. And the windshield shattered, the truck shattered. So one of my dad's job was safety officer. So any fatality or anything like that, he had to record it. So he says, I'm going to pull over and write this up. Don't get out of the car. So I sat there and then finally curiosity killed me. I look at this windshield that's gone and I see a headless torso up over the top of the steering wheel. And I think, well, it's sunny. I wear glasses. There's reflect. I'm not seeing this right. And I got out against his orders, ran to the front, and there's a decapitated head. And this guy had long braided hair. Dad's writing all this up, and I start throwing up. And he said, oh my God, you little sissy, I told you not to get out of the car. So he picks up the head by the ponytail, puts it inside the truck, writes it up, and we're driving along. And I'm just beyond mortified and sick. And he says, look, this is life. You got to face it. Everybody studies alcoholism on the reservations. They don't mean a word of it. These bars are open 7 a.m. to 2 a.m. 7 days a week. He said, this is just one gigantic hypocrisy. And guys are going to kill themselves and just get over it. So we were quiet with each other for a couple minutes, or a couple miles. And he stops his car again. Well, this time we're not near anything. We're just in pure desert land, nothing. And we're about 30 miles from home. And he gets out and he goes to his trunk and he gets a bag of water with a bowl and a big thing of beef jerky. And he says, follow me. So we start walking and a coyote had been caught in a trap because they eat sheep and goats. And Navajo culture, the coyote is evil. There's nothing good about one. So he gets to this bear trap, which is what they use to catch him. And this coyote's paw is caught in it. He can't get out. So my dad walks behind him, wraps a towel around jaw so he can't bite, uses his other hand and pulls open that trap, which God, it had to take a lot of strength. The coyote gets out and then my dad sets down a bowl of water and jerky and says, carefully walk back, very carefully walk back. He's angry and he'll attack if you confront him. So this coyote eats the jerky, drinks the water, and begins limping off. And Dad says, killing animals is wrong. It's always been wrong. The coyote's just doing what God and nature sent him to do. And then he said, stop and look around. 4.6 million years ago, this was an ocean. 3.6 million years ago, it was a volcano. And he described all the geological things, petrified wood and all of it. And for about 45 minutes, I was just his student, like I frequently could be in the greatest classroom in the world. And then he turned to me and he said, if you don't know these things, the English classics, the great authors, science, geography, all of it, you're no better than that coyote. We got in the car and drove home. It was a typical day with him. And he went from and we had just stolen all these tools. Remarkable, remarkable crime, anger, justifying bad things because bad things happened to him and the Indians. And then this act of compassion with an animal and a description of the geology of the area we grew up in, that was just breathtaking. And that was to be with my dad. You could face all those things in the same hour.
That is horrible, but interesting all at the same time. Throughout the book, there are many people who told you you wouldn't amount to anything, but a small handful encouraged you to succeed. Who were the people that helped you turn your life around?
That's a great question, and I owe my angels. I call them my angels more than I could ever pay them back. So my first angel was an 80-year-old Navajo woman. So just after the incident with my mom that I described earlier, we're living in a part of the reservation in the town of Fort Defiance, where whites are simply not allowed. And there are two gated communities in that town, one for doctors and nurses. They stay 2 years and they go back. And the teachers, which frequently did the same thing. And they're in barbed wire and completely enclosed so that nothing and no one can get to them. Well, we lived in a part where you're not supposed to live. So walking back and forth to school with just tremendous beatings every day, and just, it was horrible. So there was a woman across the street from us in what I describe as mud flats, because it was dry there, but when it rained, the whole thing was just mud, beer cans, wine, feces, you name it, just floated. Anyway, this woman walked over, Navajo woman, knocked on the door and said, "I see that you children are alone. Maybe I can help." And she became my best friend, my confidant. And I would cry and tell her bad things that had happened. And she would she'd kiss me on the forehead and say, "Learn Nazoni, the Navajo word for harmony." And she told me stories about her grandmother, age 4, that walked back and forth from the long walk, where they were slaughtered and put in prison and walked back 4 years later. And that her grandmother learned to forgive. She learned to forgive. And no matter what I told her, she said, "First you have to forgive it, and then you have to move on from it." Well, I was way too young to take that lesson, but she was my first unconditional love. She made sure I started my homework. She made sure that we were cooking some food, because my dad wasn't around much then, thank God. And she guided me, and she gave me my first marker that you could be loved by somebody that doesn't want something back from you and that isn't trying to be evil with you. And so Evelyn was my first. And then my next angel was the Navajo code talker man, who was the father of one of my best friends. Taught me Little League, who taught me 4-H. We would buy sheep and feed them and shear them, sell the wool. And he would constantly giving me tough love, right? He loved me, but I was a gigantic pain in his neck. And I was always doing crazy stuff. And one day he and his wife sat me down and said, "Look, you can always come to our house when you get beat up. We see the bruises and marks, but you have to follow our rules when you're here." And it was my first sense of what a family could be. I mean, they were poor. There were 11 kids, not enough money. They lived in one long room, but they'd leave a blanket and a pillow at the very end so that if I got beaten too bad or had nowhere to go, I could crawl to the inn and go to sleep. So those were my first two angels. And there were 5 more angels that throughout the book. And every one of the angels gave me what I needed at a time that I really needed it. And I owe them everything.
Now, let's get personal. We are all wondering if you are still in touch with your siblings and what kind of relationship you have with them now.
Yeah, I figured you would ask that. And that's a good question. It's a question that as you get older, people get uncomfortable asking, but it's a good question. So when I first started writing this book, I have they're very resentful. No, hell no, don't do it. Leave me alone. And I kept persisting, and I didn't make much headway with them. But after I got the first draft completely done, I went to my niece, who works with me, and I said, "I want you to read these chapters to your mother." And my older sister's very smart, but she blocked everything out. There are years at a time she didn't even remember where she lived. She's a professor of education. She's very bright. But she just blocked it. And I said, "Read this to your mom and ask if I have permission." And her mom would cry and stick a thumb up. And I knew that I could write it. And my big sister was always my marker for, can I write this? Went to my younger brother and he said, "You're making everything up. None of this is true. Why do you lie? Leave me alone." So I sent him a transcript and I said, "I am delighted for you to correct all my mistakes. Just name them." And he couldn't name any of them. But he stayed mad at me until after the book was published. And we gradually gradually have gotten back together. My younger sister hasn't spoken to any of us in years. These kind of childhoods do incredible damage, and there is no happy ever after. And all four of us had very tumultuous adulthoods, because one of the things that happened when you grow up like this and you leave, it doesn't leave you. You've got to consciously and aggressively undo the damage. Not easy. And it wasn't easy for any of us. And I still believe that my younger sister and younger brother live in complete denial. And I love them. And I changed their names in the book. But I did not change a single fact or anything based on their complaints. And I think they're okay with me. But the four Crow children will never get together at one time again. That is for certain.
I'm happy to hear that you're still talking.
Yeah, my older sister and I become close through one of her grandchildren. My great niece has had cancer for almost 7 years. And so I've been helpful there. And my niece, who's in her very early 30s, she works for me now. And so I have created an opportunity for her that she wouldn't have had. And we're very close. And my sister's grateful. And my sister's a good big sister, but she was at the front end of all this, and she had sexual things happen and other things happen. And I think she's proud of the fact that the book's done well and that I'm okay. She didn't want to talk about it, but she's okay with it. And we're closer than we've probably ever been. And you know, I think helping her family and her daughter with career stuff has helped. She knows that I'll be there for her. My younger brother and I he's in Colorado. When I get there, we can have dinner. Our wives know each other well enough to be friends, and we're careful about the past, but it's, you know, we're in a good place. I mean, I text him every day about something, like everything from football to, you know, can your kids go back to school? So I'm working at it. My younger sister is really angry, really bitter, and I don't know how that comes out, but all of us are open to her coming around, you know. So, yeah, I'm trying. I would never cut them off, anything like that.
So I'm curious, do you or any of your siblings still talk to your mom?
Well, I do very regularly. My mom's almost 90, and her mental illness, and particularly through COVID, she is the angriest, most bitter human being I've ever known. And she married a guy after my dad who was really a good guy. He was a very gentle truck driver, was able to get a son, which is a tricky story. Anyway, she has a son who's an adult now that takes care of her. We talk about every other day, and it's just pure anger. And I'll say, you're the only one of them still alive. You've got a nice house. You've got good food. You've got air conditioning in the summer, heat in the winter. You've got a son that lives nearby who loves you. I call you almost every day. And she's just angry and bitter. And what she wants you to do is agree with her that her life is the worst life ever lived and you should feel sorry. And I will do that to a point. What she went through was brutal, but she had a nearly 50-year marriage with her next husband who died at 91. And I'll just say, you've got to let this go, but she cannot. It's the hardest thing I do every day, every other day, is to talk to her. I dread it. I hate it. Some part of me says, how can a person live to be almost 90 and have never had a happy day or a happy thought and still stay alive? And it's a question I can't answer, because I probably have to talk to her today, and it'll just be a nonstop recital of every woe that she had. Never heard her laugh, never heard her talk about music or, you know, any of the things that it's always about her and that she suffered more than anybody. And I always tell her, I love you, Mom. I'll listen to you. It's okay. Sometimes she'll say, well, you know, I feel like all I do is complain to you. I said, it's okay. Whatever you need to do, do it. And I visit her a couple times a year, and I hate that worse than the calls. So she'll grab onto me and sit next to me and say, don't ever leave me. And so, you know, Mom, if I move back and do my job, I call you, I'll come visit you again. I'm not leaving you. But she's like a super, super angry 5-year-old that feels like life is just dumped on her with 85 more years tacked onto that, and nothing changes it. I mean, both parents were enigmas. My stepmother was just pure evil. I understood her from the start, but I don't know what it would do to take my mom to have a happy thought, but she just can't.
Wow. In the book, you describe having hearing, vision, and dyslexia issues.
Yeah, I have big time. So on an Indian reservation, again, they'll push you through school if you our breathing, right? I was in the first integrated school on the Navajo Indian Reservation, and believe me, they had big trouble because all these kids were the children of people stuck in these boarding schools where they shaved your head, washed your mouth out of a soap, and told you your religion was pagan nonsense and made you speak English, no Navajo, and they were mean. They hit them with rulers, and these were Franciscan nuns on the reservation trying to kill the Indian to save the man. So their kids were really bitter. Right. So I was behind and I knew it, but nothing was ever done, said. Then when I got in late high school in Montgomery County, Maryland, where the schools are much stronger in terms of, you know, education standard and resources, I was so far behind that in some classes I never even did anything. Right. But kind of the extreme opposite of the boarding school, this was the late 60s, you know, peace, love. And they just sort of shoved me through again. And they were going to fail me out, but my track coach loved me, my next angel, and got me through that. And he got me a diploma. He just said, look, I don't know what's wrong with you, but try to do better. So I could never hear well. I could never see well. And dyslexia, the way it is, you know, there are a lot of times that I don't react on time when I hear things, even now. But if I read anything, I can memorize it. And I learned to sort of use a playful personality and intense concentration to gradually get through. And probably the thing that saved me is I read everything and I could remember what I read. Now, that won't help you with math or chemistry or any of those things, but I got by. And at the end of my high school, I went back to reservation work construction. I came back and I walked into Montgomery Community College and on the first day of class. And some will think this is funny. Some will think this is outrageous. I walked into the dean of students and told the secretary, I need to see him. So, well, who are you? And do you have an appointment? I said, no, but he's going to want to know David Crow. He will demand to know me. So she walked back and said, you got some wise guy out here. And so he invited me in. And his name was Dr. Herm Davis. He's my fourth angel. He said, what can I do for you? And I said, I've got a small mirror and a high school diploma. He said, yeah. So I breathed on the mirror and said, the moisture shows that I'm alive, that I have respiration, and the high school diploma says, you've got to take me. Well, he burst into laughter. He thought that was the funniest thing he ever heard. So he gets me into his office, and his secretary's furious, right? Who is this little creep that did this? But he signed me up for all the classes, just called people, put him in here. We became friends, right? I knew then that I was on the lowest rung of the lowest ladder, that all the people who said I would amount to nothing would be right if I didn't make good at Montgomery College. And so for the first time in my life, even though I worked different jobs, I was on their track team, I even made All-American my first year, I knew that I had to do well there. And no matter how bad it hurts, and my eyes hurt so bad that I tried to wear contact lenses, my glasses frames are thicker than Coke bottles, but I never stopped. If I had to stay up till 3 a.m. to get a lesson done, I did it. I just knew there was no net after that. My dad kicked me out after high school, and I was glad to be kicked out, and I had to make it. And so I did. And from that moment on, I went to night school for almost 10 years, George Washington University, Maryland, Georgetown. I just worked and worked and worked and tried as hard as I could in my job. And I had open doors that I was able to get through, and I just never let up. And I'm still not letting up.
In the book, you and Sam would often have fun throwing fireworks at drunks and pranking people. Do you still like to prank people, and do you still like fireworks?
I love fireworks, but I have a wife that's on to all my games, and there are no fireworks. I have to watch them like everybody else. I still love pranks and things, but not mean pranks, you know, like I always joke with people or do silly things. I think my criminal activity's behind me. What might have been funny on a reservation or in Gallup, New Mexico, probably not very funny now. You know, I have to say, as much as everything went wrong as a kid, I had a lot of mischievous fun. And read the book, you can see it. I did every crazy thing that everybody imagines and mostly got away with it.
I found some of the things that you did to your teachers hysterical. Not that I condoned it, but it was definitely funny. I would have been laughing if I was in that class.
Good. Good. There's dark humor throughout the book, but there's dark humor throughout my life, right? That's just, I'm known for it.
Would you make this book into a movie, and has anyone approached you about it? Because I think it would really make a great movie. I'd be the first one there watching it.
I have offers on the table now, and I think as COVID light loosens, yes. I have two really substantial offers, and that I'm pursuing that. The other thing is the a very, very large book company in Russia, EKSMO, had just purchased the book for sales in Russia. And I have an agent looking at other countries that want to publish it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about your book?
Well, here's what I'd like my listeners to know, and I really believe this. It's the most important lesson is that you can be in a place that you think is so bad you can't get out, and you can be emotionally distraught where you cannot see a path forward. But honest to God, if you wake up every day and try to be better than you were the day before, open yourself up to the world in a positive light, there will be benefits that you can't imagine. And I would simply say, it's a cliche, but it's true, never, never give up. And never believe anybody who says you're too, and you can fill in the adjectives and verbs, you're too anything and you won't make it. Baloney. I always believed somehow, some way I would make it. If I had ever stopped believing that, I would be a toothless guy pumping gas on an Indian reservation if I was still alive. And I've mentored 230 college kids through internships in my lobbying business. And feel free to contact me if you have anybody there that wants to do this. I've got friends all over the world now, and certainly lots of author friends, married into a great family. Now, I had a terrible, from about 20 to 50, I struggled with everything, but I never quit. And so that's what I want my readers to know. And it can really sound like you can't get through it. There's 10 problems, but 10 problems really means one solution, and that's you. Work to get through it.
Wow, that's some really good advice.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, what did your wife think about your book after not knowing all of your secrets and then you writing a book about them? And will there be a second book, a follow-up book to continue your journey after college?
Those are good questions. So I unfortunately went through a divorce and remarriage, but very, very happily remarried for almost 15 years. My wife did not really want me to do this, right? She was not for it. My kids weren't for it. My siblings weren't for it. So at some point I had to decide that I could prove to them they were wrong about not wanting this book, and that there were very good reasons for me to write this book. They've all come around, all of them. You know, it's like, okay, this is a good thing. And my brothers-in-laws and sisters-in-laws have been very supportive. My friendship circle has been incredibly supportive. I've had clients buy like 50 books at a time and ask me to come give a talk. I've given a lot of talks on the book. I already do a bunch on politics anyway, which is sort of what I'm trained to do. But as far as a sequel from the moment on, that I won't do, because that involves my children. It also involves everybody in my life now beyond my siblings and my mother. So I've got a deal to write three books for about Gallup and the Navajo Indian Reservation, concentrating on that. And if no one else would be hurt by a sequel, a direct sequel, I would do it. But I don't believe I hurt anybody in the first book. I believe I'd hurt people in the second one. And if your family's mad at you, you're not going to do very well. So they've said absolutely no.
Well, that's good to know. And I'll be interested to see your new books when they do come out. We want to thank you for coming on this show and offering all this valuable insight on how to persevere through the toughest times of your life. I learned a lot from reading your book, and I know all of our listeners will too. We are all about humans helping humans. We hope you will join us again on our show for another episode.
I will be glad to, and I can share slices of my life after this book, and I'd be delighted to do that. And if I can only ask your listeners one thing, if they like the book, would they please go to Goodreads and Amazon and just do a short little brief, just post a brief little note. That really helps an author.
And please also support the author by purchasing his book, The Pale-Face Lie. A portion of the proceeds goes towards Barrett House, a homeless shelter for women in Albuquerque. Here's to another informative episode of College Talks and More.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Subscribe to our podcast and YouTube channel to stay up to date on any new episodes.
Check out our blog and be an insider to receive our newsletters so you can follow anything and everything College Talks and My Book Heart.